Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, and I am here. It is book discussion. I am so excited. It's a beautiful night. It's freezing outside in Westchester County, but we don't really care. When I finish telling you about this book and we finish talking about it, you're going to want to read it in front of a beautiful fire in a log cabin with snow outside. The title of the book is Christmas in Snowflake Canyon, and the author is New York Times bestseller Raeann Thain. Hi, Raeann.
Hi, Fran. How are you today?
We're hanging in there. We're fine. And how are you?
The weather here is
so cold, but it's beautiful, and I hate wearing a jacket, and it's 40 degrees, and Miss Brilliant went outside without a coat, but you know what?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I walked up and I looked up at the sky and I go, like, make me freeze. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. So I am so
and we had snow last night here, so we've
oh,
got
nice.
Snow on the ground.
Oh, that's nice.
It is.
But do they plow the snow and get rid of it? That's the thing.
Oh, it wasn't that much. It was only about an inch or so. But the mountains are all white and covered, so it looks beautiful out my window right now. It's kind of gray and overcast, but it's pretty with a little bit of snow. Gets you in the mood for the holidays, I guess.
Oh, it's nice. It makes a nice cover for a book.
Right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Well, this book was really such a pleasant surprise. It really is. And yesterday on my show, I picked out, and I'm going to add three more right now. I have every single year I pick the top 50 books that I think are the top 50 books for 2013. So yesterday I announced the first nine. So today we're just going to add three. We've got Mark Schaff, Redemption Road, Mark Rubenstein's Love Gone Mad. We've got Delaney Oaks, Ninja Tattoo, Karen Vaughn, The Queen of Craziness, she's a comedy, Daytona Dead. We've got Alan Topol's The Russian Endgame, New York Times bestselling author John Land's The Tenth Circle, Marcia Cook, The Queen of Romance, the Virginia Templeton stories, and Stuart Yates' Roadkill. His story scared me terribly. Nightmares. It was so scary. And Michael Tamman, Big Banatent. But today we get to add Christmas in Snowflake Canyon as one of Fran's 10 top picks for the year. These are in no particular order, people, but of course some of them belong at the top like that one. And we've got Broken Allegiance by Mark Young. And we've got a few more that I'll announce during the week. The Bully List by Michael Embry is an excellent book for kids. So there's the first 12 people, and the rest you're going to have to wait for. And the reason why I announce them, in case you want to get a book for Hanukkah or Christmas, why don't you just start with these and go on Amazon and get one of each? Or maybe a couple of Snowflake, Christmas in Snowflake Canyon by Raeann Thain. So Raeann, tell us, why did you decide to put Dylan and Genevieve in the same novel? Tell us a little about them. That
was
so cool.
I first introduced Genevieve in the very first Hope's Crossing book, which was called Blackberry Summer, and I never intended to write her as a heroine. She was just one of those characters that I really just introduced because I wanted to show the heroine of that book was this very nice person who managed to deal with everybody in a very kind way, and that's sort of, I needed to show somebody who sort of was a foil for the nice heroine of that book. Mm. And Genevieve was perfect. She was this spoiled debutante. She was throwing this perfect wedding. Everything had to be exactly right, and so, you know, basically I just was showing her to sort of show how good the heroine was of that book by contrasting her with Genevieve. And then throughout the other books, as certain things happened to Genevieve, the second and third books, I was just intrigued with this character, and from the very beginning I could tell she didn't really want to get married, but I didn't know why. It was just kind of one of those throwaway ideas that you write when you're writing a secondary character. And then when I proposed the idea for the next three, I couldn't shake the idea that I wanted to write Genevieve's story. I wanted to find out, you know, what was behind the mask of this perfect debutante, beautiful woman who had everything that anybody could want, and what went on, you know, underneath the surface of that. And so she just seemed a perfect heroine to me, and I was intrigued by her character. And then
I had to think of who's a good hero for her. And, of course, I introduced Dylan in, about the fourth book, and I knew from the beginning that he was exactly who I wanted to have as her hero. And the two of them, from the very first page when I first started writing this book, they had chemistry that I didn't expect, and it just sort of took over the whole book. I just loved them together.
Well, I liked him to start with because he's got personality. And he doesn't let anybody step on him. And she was becoming, like, annoying in the last book. And in this one, you finally get to know her for the kind of person that she really is, which we won't tell anybody too much about her. So,
right. You can't give away all the secrets, right?
Yeah. Her mother reminds me of somebody I know.
Oh,
that always worries about materialistic things and doesn't really care about anything except how things look.
Right.
So why do her parents treat her? Her father treats her as if she's useless and, you know, nothing. And her mother just needs her to shop with her. Why do they treat her like that? They don't even give her a chance to be who she is.
Well, I think in their situation, neither of her parents grew up with money, and then suddenly they had a lot of it. Her father was one of the founders of the ski resort that in Hope's Crossing that ended up making a lot of money. And so suddenly they were in a totally different social stratosphere and didn't deal with it well, either one of them, and sort of became grasping. Her mother became, you know, very much wanted her daughter to have the perfect marriage and the politically advantageous, you know, union. And so really that's sort of the way they filtered everything through having all this money all of a sudden. But, you know, I try to write her parents a little, maybe not necessarily sympathetic, but hopefully with a little bit of depth there that you'd think there's more to them than on the surface as well, that her mother was, there was some loneliness in her mother, and she really wanted to be liked, but didn't quite know how to go about it, given the fact that, you know, her money sort of set her apart from everybody else in town, at least in her mind. And so, they're interesting characters.
They are interesting characters. But why did you, I read that very first scene, and I thought I was in the OK Corral or on Gunsmoke with Miss Kitty. And I wrote that. I was like, oh, my God. This was so hysterical. I said, and this was typically not the way you start your books. And I'm going like, somebody is thinking out of the box, because I immediately fell in love with Genevieve, and I said, man, you didn't like that Christmas Carol. You don't want to hear it. And how many times have you gone into a store or apartment store or just on the street and listening to the same Christmas Carol 1,000 times or any kind of song? You're like, enough already. So how come you started it and Deck the Halls in 17 different ways? Oh, my God.
It was just kind of one of those scenes that sort of came to me. I needed to bring them together in some way that would get them both in trouble, and I had to, but not in enough trouble that, you know, they would be in a ton of trouble, but enough that they would have to make amends for what they'd done, and I had to throw them in a situation, two strangers who really didn't like each other, didn't really know each other, and both had to be, you know, responsible for the same opportunity, and that just seems the perfect thing. So for the setup for those listeners who haven't read the book, it's Black Friday, and they end up going to a bar. Both of them separately go to this bar, and Genevieve, somebody there is playing Christmas music in a bar on Black Friday when people are there to sort of escape the craziness of Black Friday, and so she's had enough and starts a bar fight over this song, and Dylan steps in to help, and they both end up getting arrested for it and handcuffed together, and fun ensues after that, I guess.
I thought that was hysterical. And all that's who they got in trouble with was even funnier. And I was just like, and she actually thought that she was going to get away with it, and the fact that she didn't really, it's about time she, you know, people are accountable for their actions or whatever. And I don't know a whole lot of people that think that they don't have to be accountable for their actions. That is really sad. So she goes and she gets arrested, and they're sitting in the back of the police car together, which I thought was hilarious too, and thinking of whatever. Why does she decide to use the same lawyer?
Well, her father is already pushing her around before. That's the reason she was in the bar, is that her father has brought her back. She's been living in Paris since her engagement broke up at the end of the third book in the series, which is Three Laurel Falls. So for the last 2 years, she's been living in Paris, living off her father's money, just basically spending it like crazy and having a wonderful time shopping and trying to heal her broken heart. Her parents thought that that's, you know, that she deserved this time to sort of heal, but they're tired of it now. And so her father has already manipulated her, brought her back to Hope's Crossing, told her he's cutting her off financially unless she, you know, shapes up, and has given her the chance to sort of make amends by living in this horrible house that she hates and selling this house, and then she can use that money to fund, you know, some sort of career for herself. But he's had enough of her basically just spending his money like crazy, and so she's already mad at her dad, doesn't want him to represent her or anybody in his law firm. And so she automatically gravitates towards Dylan's brother, who happens to be an attorney as well. And so Dylan's brother sort of, you know, doesn't quite know how to deal with this, but is willing to take her on as a client because, you know, he doesn't like her father necessarily either. And so Andrew Kane, who's Dylan's brother, is able to sort of negotiate a plea deal for the two of them. In exchange, they don't have to serve jail time. Instead, they have to do community service at A Warrior's Hope, which was the charity that was started in the fourth book of the series to help wounded veterans who have to give them recreational opportunities in this mountain community in Colorado.
Yeah, well, and that was when, at the end of the last book, when Charlotte wanted him to join and come there, and he wouldn't do it. So now
right.
He's got no choice. But she was the one that agreed to do this, and how come Dylan wasn't going to do it? She said, I'm going to jail. Forget it. I'm not doing this.
Well,
that was hilarious.
You know.
I go like, oh, really? You're going to not do this? Right. Okay, sure.
Well, Dylan is, you know, he's an interesting character, and he just didn't, he's dealing with his own demons, and he didn't see the point in, you know, taking these soldiers who have been through terrible circumstances and are facing a lifetime of challenges now. He didn't see the point of spending a week in the mountains and how that was going to help them. He thought it was a big waste of time and just a little, you know, fairy tale that they can make everybody better by, you know, taking them on sleigh rides and mm-hmm. skiing and things like that. And so he didn't want to be part of it. Plus, I think he's also was at a stage in his own healing from his own injuries that he didn't, you know, there comes a point, I think, when everybody has a traumatic time and they're maybe grieving for the loss of their life that they've left behind, when they have to decide whether they want to move forward and whether they don't. And he's sort of on the brink of that and knows he's on the brink of that, trying to decide whether how to move forward, and he's fighting it because he's, you know, he's angry about what's happened to him, and he's hurt and doesn't want to go on, you know.
Well, you described that in the book, but I'm not going to tell everybody what you wrote, but that was really interesting. The fact that you included what happened and explained it and set the scene so that everybody that reads the book will actually, you know what Dylan went through and go through it with him, which I thought was really great. Because for those people that didn't read the other one, you wouldn't understand it unless you know, went through the pain and the sorrow and the fighting and what happened to him.
Right.
And his
right.
nightmares. That was good because I said, oh, my God. Now I understand why he's so angry. But
right.
Jen decides,
angry and guilty. I mean, there's a guilt associated with it as well in his circumstance where he sort of feels responsible and feels that, you know, he should have been able to prevent what happened, and friends of his died in this in the same attack where he was injured and lost his arm and his eye. And so he's got a mess. He's a mess. We'll just say that. He's kind of a mess.
He's a mess, and he needs to be repaired. He needs help.
Right.
Mental
right.
help. But, you know, sometimes we don't realize what's right in front of us, and sometimes we push it aside. So he needed a little nudge somewhere.
Right.
Hope Crossing is probably a town that everybody wants to live in because the people that live there are just so special. But when they go to Warriors Hope's Warrior, who were the new characters that you introduced in this particular book that, you know, work with him? And of course, I really wish there was a picture of Spencer. Because, yeah, I mean, everybody's looking at Charlotte and going like, she looks good, but how did you get super stud? I mean,
right.
the man just, you just have to put his name on the page, and I'm trying to figure out oh my God, this guy is gorgeous, and Dylan probably is gorgeous. But the minute anyone goes near Spencer, I mean, she'll poke their eyes out. Forget it, Charlotte. That's when she's going to get nasty. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking for pictures. I'm saying, like, she has to put pictures of these guys in the book.
Yeah, that would be good.
Cover.
And I did some good research on that, trying to find, you know, what characters look like and stuff. So just background, Spence is was Dylan's best friend. They were very, very good friends. And he's now engaged to marry Dylan's sister, Charlotte. Their story was Willow Leaf Lane, which was the fifth book in the series. And and Spence was a professional baseball player. His nickname was Smokin' Hot. And because he was a pitcher Smokin' Hot Spence Gregory, and because he was great looking as well. And so he is this charismatic character, but does nothing for Genevieve. She's astonished that he should do something for her, but all she can think about is Dylan when she's around Spence. And so, you know, I like that idea that even though, you know, sometimes people can be gorgeous, but if they're not the person that you care about, it doesn't matter how gorgeous they are. You know, it doesn't matter.
I know, it's not what a person looks like. It's the person is inside, but there are
right,
a lot of superficial
right.
people in the world. We know that.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So what are they asked to do at Warrior's Hope that, whatever they were asked to do sounded like fun, actually. I mean, hard work, but fun.
Well,
and she loved it.
She loved it because Genevieve has a degree in interior design. She hasn't really done anything with it because she's been playing around. First she was going to get married, and then she was playing around in Paris. But she does have a degree in interior design, and she loves it. She loves decorating and things like that. She loves sewing, oddly. She loves to sew. When she shows up at A Warrior's Hope, it's the perfect thing because they have these new cabins. They're having a new camp come in about a week and a half before Christmas, and of new wounded veterans and their families coming to spend a week at Hope's Crossing. And so they have these brand new cabins that have just been finished, and she gets charged with decorating them for Christmas. And Dylan is assigned to do the same thing with her. So for Genevieve, it's a wonderful assignment. For Dylan, it's like misery to have to stand there and put ornaments on a Christmas tree. It's absolutely the last thing he would want to do. So I liked that scene, but then he actually finds himself kind of enjoying himself. And I really loved, again, the chemistry between them and the fact that he discovers that he loves to listen to her talk, and he doesn't know why, but she just, her chattering away about anything and nothing is very comforting to him, and he really enjoys being with her, to his great astonishment. And so I just loved writing that scene and these two people who are kind of fighting their attraction for each other.
I liked it also. And it was just so nice to read a book that, you know, you're going to guess what happens or whatever, but yet it was just so nice to read a book about that was so pleasant and so positive, because I've been reading so many that are so, I don't want to read them. And why did Charlotte give her like a cold or lukewarm or maybe icy reception? She didn't exactly, she wasn't thrilled to see Genevieve there. I mean, she accepted her, but she wasn't exactly thrilled.
I think from Charlotte's perspective, she felt like Genevieve got her brother in trouble, for one thing. It was Genevieve's fault that they got in the bar fight, and that Dylan was in trouble. And, you know, Genevieve has this reputation. People perceived her as one thing in town, and that was as the witchy, you know, socialite who had to have her own way and was spoiled and kind of pushed everybody around and wasn't very nice after her engagement broke up and wasn't very nice to the people in Hope's Crossing and didn't want to be in Hope's Crossing. She's been living in Paris for 2 years, so she sort of has this disdain for this little provincial Colorado town as she sees it, you know. And so, of course, people aren't going to be that receptive to her. And so Charlotte was concerned, and also I think Charlotte could see there was a bit of attraction between the two of them, and she's worried about her brother because her brother's been hurt enough, and she doesn't want to see him get hurt again by this woman that she doesn't see much good in at first.
Well, do people sometimes determine how somebody is? So
right.
It's going to be hard for anybody. People just don't give other people a chance at times either. I don't think that's fair. I mean, sometimes I wonder, you know, you look at somebody and you say, okay, this person is however, and most people, unfortunately, prejudged Charlotte. I prejudged Genevieve and didn't really give her a chance to be anything.
Right. And but she,
I don't
also,
know, it's
she
hard,
earned,
yeah.
She earned her reputation in a lot of ways. She earned it. You know, I mean, her behavior wasn't good, and she is at a stage in her life now where she can look back and say, wow, I made a lot of mistakes. And so overcoming those mistakes is sort of her challenge, how to overcome people's prejudice against her, well-earned, you know, resentment of her because of her behavior, how to show that, you know, she's trying to do something different and become someone different. And so absolutely I agree with you that sometimes people have a blanket view of someone and won't, you know, look beneath what they expect to see in that person. In Genevieve's case, that was true to some extent, but also that, you know, she deserved her reputation in large part. I mean, people didn't see the motive behind it. They just saw the behavior, but the behavior was poor enough that of course, you know, people are going to have that perspective of her.
Yeah, and it takes a long time before somebody changes their perspective of her.
Right.
As they're getting the cabins done, what was their reaction when they finally finished it? What did Charlotte think, and what did everybody else think when they saw what she had done?
Well, people loved it. They thought it looked beautiful, and you know, they were kind of teasing Dylan about it and teasing that he was involved in it. And Dylan was, I think, kind of resentful still that he had been dragged into it. Jen thought they were sort of, you know, establishing a bit of a friendship. They've been working together all day long, and they'd been talking about lots of things. But because, you know, he could feel her getting a little bit closer than he was ready for, and so he was not very nice to her at the end of that scene. Kind of pushed her away again.
I actually felt bad for her because she was actually trying to be positive and not carry on, and not whatever. The scene that really got me was when she finally meets the people that are coming there, all of the families that come. How did she break the ice? I mean, she stood on the side for a while and didn't say anything, and then all of a sudden she became the focal point of everything. What happened with her? Because she just stood on the side. She didn't think that she had anything to say, and she felt kind of insecure with all these people.
Right. I think that it was one of those situations where she was completely out of her element. You know, she was used to being around these perfect socialites like her, you know, people who dressed perfectly and who knew all the social manners and things like that. And suddenly here she is thrust into this situation where she's surrounded by wounded, physically maimed men, rough men, you know, for the most part, and women. I did have a woman soldier there as well, and so she didn't know how to respond, and she felt like she would say the wrong thing and possibly say something that would be offensive. She felt like it was wiser to just stay quiet and sort of stay on the sidelines. But she's drawn to one young man who's there, who's in a wheelchair, and he's just this very polite Southern boy, and they end up talking, and he tells her she reminds him of somebody, and so they end up having just a little conversation, and before she knows it, other people, they're talking about shopping with some of the wives of the soldiers, and that puts her back in her element, you know, these kind of universal feminine things to talk about.
Yeah, shopping, yeah, you get me to do that.
And shoes.
My favorite
and purses.
Thing, too, people. Besides your viewing books, just, you know, a card, you know, a gift card to any, you know, nice store. What the heck? I don't care where it is.
There you go. There you go. And so then she just sort of her natural, I think naturally, socially, she's very accomplished socially. She's used to talking to many different people, and so it just took, I think, those points of commonality for her to feel comfortable and with these people that at first frightened her a little bit because she didn't know how to respond to them.
Well, that's because she really never had the opportunity to really allow herself to be anything.
Right.
I think for some reason, and I'm just thinking about that now, that she had like a wall up in front of her. And she was just afraid to be somebody that maybe her parents didn't want her to be. Or maybe she just did all this stuff because she didn't want to be who her parents wanted her to be. She wanted to be somebody else. And maybe, you know, spending all the money and shopping was what her mother would want. And I think one of the best scenes in the book was when her mother came and asked her to go shopping, and then she forgot she was supposed to go to lunch with her, and she said that she had the responsibility to go to a warrior's hope. That was a turning point for me.
I think it was, absolutely. I think you're wise to pick up on that. It was a turning point because the old Genevieve would have jumped at the excuse to do something. You know, when her parents tried to get her out of this obligation,
yeah.
The old Genevieve would have said, you know, yeah, absolutely, I don't want to do this, so I shouldn't have to do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But she was maturing and becoming someone different and someone better, and she had felt like she had a responsibility by that point to do what she had committed to do, which was to help volunteer. They had this new group of campers coming in, you know, camp participants, and she felt like she needed to be there to help, as she had promised that she would.
Well, sometimes a bad situation can turn out to be something good, because you never know. So the next scene that really got me, and it did fit, because I'm saying if this would have gone too smoothly, I would have said then there was something not right. But when Charlotte invites her the first time, she doesn't go. But she invites her to Moira's bookstore for a girls' night out, and everyone there tried really hard except for one person. You know,
that's
I wanted to get her too. One of these days, somebody's going to just tell her off and tell the old ditch what to do.
That's right.
But I felt bad that Jen didn't stand up to her.
Well, you know, I think when somebody's making sort of such a monumental shift in who they have been and who they're trying to become, there's a lot of insecurity involved in that. And that was the same way with Genevieve. You know, this. Ruth didn't say anything that Genevieve hadn't thought about and thought that that's how everybody looked at her. So there's a character called Ruth Tatum who sort of is one of those antagonistic characters throughout the series that
she always
says what she's thinking, and she's not very nice to people, and she's just kind of one of those difficult people that I think most of us know who just can't be happy no matter how hard you try. And she was the mother of the heroine of Blackberry Summer, and they sort of tolerate her sometimes, but they all got on her after she was not nice to Genevieve. She said some things out of Genevieve's hearing, she thought, but Genevieve overheard what she said, and to Genevieve that was what she thought everybody was thinking. And so sort of all her insecurities came bubbling up, and she ended up leaving this party, this opportunity that she had to sort of make some female friends in town where she hadn't really had any, or her other female friends sort of had all dropped her after she didn't marry this perfect man that everybody thought she should, and so she'd lost friends here. She had friends in France, but she didn't have any in Hope's Crossing at this point. And so,
fact that they told her that she should have married Sawyer would have been really stupid. After all she did, that would have been really like lowering herself even more. And then people said to her, one of her friends actually said, you know what, so what if he did it, he's rich, blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't mean he's not going to do it again.
Right, absolutely.
She winds up is really hilarious.
Well, I think that decision that she made not to marry him was the turning point for her character development in this book, you know. I mean, because there are probably plenty of people who would have just gone ahead with it and just said whatever, you know, and forgiven him. And just at that point, they were only a few weeks away from the wedding and would have said, well, it's too late. I'm not going to cancel everything. I'm not going to deal with the social embarrassment or whatever. But Genevieve had the strength at that point to say, this isn't what I want for the rest of my life. You know, I don't want to deal with this, and I think accept at that point that she didn't love him anyway, you know. And so if she'd loved him, maybe she might have, you know, tried to make it into a prettier picture than it was, but she didn't love him anyway. And so she didn't see the point of throwing her life away on a jerk who she didn't love
anyway. Maybe Sage did her a favor. You never know.
Maybe.
So how did she feel? What happens when she faces Moira? And then she had to face Claire. That was even worse.
Okay, so she faced Moira at the book party, the book club party, and she was very embarrassed to face her, and because she'd said not nice things about Mara's daughter, Sage, for reasons that are revealed in book three, through Laurel Falls.
We won't tell anybody. They have to read book three for our sorry.
And, you know, Genevieve actually found the strength
to do something that's very difficult for many people and to apologize for the things that she mm-hmm. said and the way that she acted. And she apologized and also basically said to Mara, probably not in the most, you know, smooth of ways, but said that she was happy that an innocent party, we'll just leave it at mm-hmm. that, an innocent party was doing well because of, you know, she was because of what, because of the consequences of everything, Mara is involved in dealing with this innocent person. And so Genevieve basically made things nice with Mara, which was a huge effort for her. And then later, the scene with Claire happens a little bit later. She has to go, she was not very nice to Claire in the bead store and was very demanding of her when during the process of planning her wedding and then sort of stiffed her on the bill for work that Claire had done on Genevieve's wedding dress. And Genevieve decides she needs this wedding dress for reasons that happen in the plot. So she has to sort of go and humble herself before Claire and tell her she is sorry for the way she treated her and that, you know, she shouldn't have acted that way. So basically,
we're not going to tell everybody why she needed the dress and what happened, because that would spoil the fun of finding out how she gets in trouble and a whole bunch of other stuff.
She does cause some trouble, doesn't she?
She does cause a lot of trouble, but in this particular case, it was positive trouble.
Yes,
so
it was.
So how come Dylan's father, because I'm not giving away any more of the good plot at the end, how come Dylan's father thinks that Genevieve is so great, and he made him get her some pie and a dinner, and he made him bring it to her? That was hilarious too.
I think that there are certain people in this world who can see beneath the surface, who happen to have that skill of seeing to the heart of people, and I've written Dermot throughout the series as one of those people.
I like him.
I do too, and he just sees who people are inside, and so he's always liked Genevieve, and he's always been kind to her. And you know, he sees, maybe he is a little more perceptive than some people, and sees beneath the perfect gloss that has always surrounded her to maybe somebody who's a little awkward, socially awkward, and a little bit shy, maybe things that she doesn't reveal to the world. And so he's always had a soft spot for her. And also, I think, as a loving father, he's aware of his children, and when he finds out that there's something happened between Genevieve and Dylan, and that there's still something between them, and kind of everybody senses this, even though people are shocked by it and don't see them as a couple that should be together, he wants to foster that, and so he sort of masterminds things so that he asks Dylan to drop a few things off at Genevieve's house one evening after a family dinner.
So he's not really unhappy if he winds up with her.
Likes Genevieve, and he loves his son. And if she's making his son, you know, sort of want to come back to the world a little bit, his son has, you know, Dylan has been hiding out in Snowflake Canyon where he has this cabin, and he hasn't wanted to hang out with his family, and he hasn't wanted to socialize at all. He's just sort of there nursing his wounds and drinking and just being unhappy. And I think Dermot can sense that that something's changed in his son's attitude a little bit, and wants to foster that and do everything he can to help his son.
So will Dermot ever ask Catherine for a date?
Well.
I think that they are, you know, it's just my aunt, before she died, with my mom, they would go to this senior center and drag me with them, even though I was married, to this Riverdale center. And the two of them would get into so much trouble. I mean, it was hilarious. My aunt was like 80-something, and my mother was 70-something. And these guys would come over to them and check them out. And, of course, I was there, and they would go, "Oh, hi, sweetie, you're a cute little guy, cute young kid." And I go, "Oh, okay, this is fun." And, I mean, I could just see the two of them together. They're just so cute, though. But how come they won't realize? I mean, they realize they like each other. So what's the problem here?
Well, it's a pivotal scene in the book that I'm currently writing right now.
Oh,
so
good.
I'm getting
there's more.
Much,
I didn't want to think this was the end of it.
No. I will tell you, it was it was going to be the end. Christmas in Snowflake Canyon was going to be the end. That was the last one. And my publisher said, well, let's start a new series. And so we were coming up with ideas for a new series. And as I started working on ideas for a new series, I was like, wait, I got all these things I need to wrap up, and especially Dermot's story with Catherine. I had to figure out a way to sort of wrap that up. And so I am doing one more Hope's Crossing book right now. I'm working on it right now. It's called Wild Iris Ridge, and it will be out in June. And it's the story of Brendan Kane, who is Dylan's brother. He's a widower, and he has two young children. And his story sort of, Dermot's story with Catherine sort of is a pivotal turning point in that book. So I've been excited to finally get to Dermot. I said I couldn't leave them not together, and I didn't wrap it up in Christmas in Snowflake Canyon. Now I got to wrap it up, you know.
No, so. But you have to do one more thing. You got to bring Sage and Genevieve together.
I want
to see what happens when those two wind up in the same place together.
Well, I haven't done that yet, but I do have to tell you that I am doing a new series, but I kind of, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking sometime I'm going
to
come back to Hope's Crossing, because maybe when Sage grows up a little bit more, I would like to write her story at some point.
Yeah, you got to bring Henry into it.
Yeah, and Taryn, you know, when she grows up a little bit, I'd like to write her story.
Yeah, from the younger group, the younger generation's perspective,
Right.
And Charlie. Yeah.
I want to
be a character in Hope Crossing too.
Okay, all right. I will have a Fran.
You would have a Fran, and I could be the resident nosy book reviewer.
There you go. Because every town needs one, right?
Everybody needs a nosy town book reviewer. I always wanted to be a character in a really good novel, and someone's supposed to write me in as a villain, but I really want to be a pain in the neck, which is more like me. No, it would really be fun. It would be fun to be a character in Hope's Crossing because the characters are just so cool, and I would fit in definitely in the book club without a doubt.
Good. Perfect.
And let's see what's my next question here. Okay, so we know what's coming next, but before you decided to become an author of all these great books, and I wrote down that this book is coming out in June because I'm not going to text you to remind you to send it. Just send it. When is the next one coming out? Because I looked at, I think I wrote it down, and I think I have the list of the new series that you're coming out with on a piece of paper somewhere, and you're coming out with a whole bunch of new ones.
Right. Well, I have.
So what is it? What is that one called?
So the new series. Well, it doesn't really have a name right now. Our tentative name, my tentative name for it was Lake Solace, but I think we're changing that. But the first book in that will be out next November, and it's also another Christmas book, and it's another small town series that I'm starting, and it's sort of a bridge book in that. It's another of the Kane brothers. It's Aidan Kane, who I haven't really introduced yet, but I've mentioned him a few times in the previous books. And so he's going to be the first character, first hero in this new series
nice.
In a new community. So I just finished sort of the proposal for that one, and his situation is that he's this wealthy tech guy who, through a business deal, gets this land, and it's kind of a mess, and he needs to fix it up, and this woman helps him sort of fix it up in time for Christmas when his family is all coming. So all the Canes will be reappearing in that one. He brings everybody to this new community that I haven't yet come up with a name for.
What are the ones I saw on your website then? I have the paper here. It says Island Promises.
Oh, yeah. Those are not. I do have upcoming books this year. So this is my new series for my new single title series. But I also have a book that's actually available on sale right now. It's called A Cold Creek Christmas Surprise. I do a series for Solette Special Edition called The Cowboys of Cold Creek, and this is like the 12th book in this series. And these are small category romances that are, you know, like 65,000 words. So they're not the big, thicker single title books, but I've had a really wonderful time writing this series, and readers really seem to enjoy the Cowboys of Cold Creek, so I keep coming back for more there. And so that book is out right now, and then I did a novella, so it's a very short, 25,000-word short story with Marie Farrella and Leanne Banks called Island Promises, and it's on sale in January. This anthology goes on sale in January, so it's just three
shorts. I saw that. You have to send that to me because small books are good.
I will. I'll send you both of those.
Good.
I'll send you both
small books are good. As a matter of fact, I was very excited the other day, and I didn't expect it. They just sent me Jeffrey Deaver's book, The October List, but more importantly, they sent it in large print.
Oh, that does help, yeah.
Not only does it help, it pushes it to the top of the list because anybody that sends me a book in, you know, one font or four font has to wait. And anybody that sends me a book like your books are easy because I could actually see them with or without my glasses. And then when I get these books that the print is so small, I go like, forget it, you're going in the corner. I can't read you now. Because then I get
I'm embarrassed to admit that I mostly read on my my iPad mini anymore because I can blow the font up as big as I need it. And so that's the best. I used to read on my Kindle
read
for
them.
The same reason, but no,
I can only read print books with large print. Forget it. And somebody just sent me, and I'm reading it now. I won't say who. He sent me a manuscript, and I ask people that send me a manuscript, you know, that they print out, which I appreciate that they print it out, please put it in a folder and make sure the page numbers are on it. I have gotten quite a few without page numbers. So before you became an author, you were a journalist, right?
I was, yes.
That's
I spent
right.
10 years
and
working
what,
for a daily newspaper.
And what type of articles did you write?
When I started out, actually I started writing sports stories. I was in college, still in college, and I was a sports reporter for the local daily paper. Just because that they only hired college students to do part-time sports work, and I was desperate to get my foot in the door, and I did enjoy high school basketball and high school football, so I really enjoyed doing that. And then I got a job after I graduated from college. I got a job at the same newspaper as just a beat reporter. My beat was the city government, county government. I ended up doing some state government, so I covered all the city council meetings, that kind of story. And then I was there for about 2 years doing reporting. And I would write feature stories as well. And then I went to work I got another job as the news editor for the paper, and I did that for my last about 7 years there. I was basically the one who designed the paper and wrote the headlines and picked the stories that would go in the paper. So that was my job.
So what made you change? What made you decide to give that up and become an author?
Well, I knew from the beginning that newspapers – journalism wasn't really – I love telling stories, but I like telling stories that made people feel good, and you don't always get that opportunity in newspapers. And so it just didn't fit my personality very well. And I've always read – I've always been an avid reader, and I've always loved romance novels, and I knew that someday I wanted to try to write one. And so I did, and I started after I'd been at the paper for 2 or 3 years. I started – kind of a romance novel on the side at home on my own. You know, I'd get up early in the morning and work on it before I'd go to work and work on it at night. And it took me about 5 years, and I wrote 2 books in those 5 years, which isn't very much at all in the scheme of things, but felt like a lot for me because I had a young daughter at the time. And then sold Bantam Love Swept in 1995. Which is a line that was discontinued, and then they just recently started it up again. And then I quit full time after I'd sold about 5 books, Bantam, just because this is what I wanted to do anyway. Was be a mom and write full time. And so I've been doing it ever since. That's been 16 years now that I've been doing it full time.
It's great to do something that you really want to do, though.
It is. It makes life a lot easier. And people always say, well, it must be so wonderful. And it is wonderful to be
it
a writer,
wonderful
you know,
when
but
you're doing
it,
what, when you want to do it, when you really love what you're doing though.
It is. But it's a job like any other, you know, it's different than it was when I was doing it as sort of a dream of being published. It's a different attitude when it's a job like any other. I have to do it whether I want to or not some days, you know. And so it's different, but I love it. I couldn't imagine doing anything else, and it's perfect for my situation and working around my kids' schedules and working around, you know, doctor's appointments and that sort of thing. So it works out very well.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. When I retired from teaching and my mom was sick, I decided I had to do something, And I love being a reading and writing staff developer. I love teaching kids. I love writing. And I love getting them to write. And that was the most fun because my topics were over the top and way off base, and everybody loved it. But, you know, I never, ever, ever thought that I would do radio. I mean, that was a dare. And I never, ever, ever thought that I would write 11 books, and I'm still trying to figure out how to get that one special one, even though I've written 11, and they're good. But I think the project that I just started, which is the best, which you are featured in, by the way, I have to send you a copy of. Yes, you are. yes, you are. In MJ Magazine came out, the second edition came out. I'm going to email you a copy of the magazine, and it features all of the book reviews I did except for this last one because I'm going to put that in the next one. It's got Blackberry Mountain and Willow Leaf Lane and all of the other ones that I read before. And everything about your books and your bio and all the rest of it is in there. And it's on the front cover. It says it.
Yay.
I did an online thing with Tess Gerrinson, and I said I was going to feature you in that one also. It's exciting because it's in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who was my biggest critic in the world, God bless her. And she used to edit my books, and that's when they didn't have any mistakes, everybody. And when I wrote my first children's book, she was the most critical because I was telling the truth about life growing up. So, I mean, I featured, you know, certain articles, certain authors, and I sent you the interview questions, but a lot of the authors are not doing interviews. They're doing writing tips or editing ideas or publishing thought or marketing tips, and they're sending me articles that I publish in the magazine too.
Oh, great.
So anybody that wants, you can feel free to do that. The next one I think is going to come out probably in January because it's just taken me time since my surgery to do anything, except that this is like the first hour that I feel much better. whenever I do my radio show, I feel much better, seriously. But I have to tell you that you are featured in that particular one. But before if one of the characters in Hope Crossing would do an assessment or say, what do they admire about Ray Ann the most? What would they say? Which character do you think would say to you that they admire you the most, and why?
Oh, that's a hard question. One I am not prepared for. Let's see.
Well, which character do you feel the closest to?
For the whole series?
Now, which one do you think is more like your personality? Catherine?
Catherine is. I would have to say Claire is. I mean, because
Claire.
I do try to help people, and I try to do...
Yeah.
I sometimes do too much, which is Claire's problem. I try
Me
to do
too.
More than I have time to do. And so, you know, I try to help others, and that was Claire's whole personality. And so I would say I probably empathize a lot with her. With actually, oddly, this is weird, but Brody Thorne, you know, in his situation where he was helping his child who was injured.
Well,
I've spoken previously about my son who has a brain injury, and so I really empathized with Brody's situation and what he was going through and some of the emotions that he was going through.
Yeah, my sister had a traumatic brain injury besides the heart attack when she died. So, yeah, that's one of my charities, the Kessler Foundation, to do some more research as to why these things happen and how to prevent them from happening. So we know what's next, so tell everybody before we close where they can find out more about you and more about your books.
Sure. My website is rayannthane.com, and that's RAEANNETHAYNE. And then you can find me on Facebook as well under author Rayann Thane. I'm actually probably most active on Facebook in terms of any of the other social media. You can interact with me probably the most there. On my author page, and again, that's author Rayann Thane. I have a personal page, Rayann Thane, but I don't do much on that one. So, the best place to find me is my author page.
Those are the best places to find out about me. I am on Twitter, but I don't tweet that often, and so Facebook is probably your best bet.
I never realized how much I tweet after getting over 1,200 people that decided for some reason to follow me. I don't know where they're following. Yeah, my nephew called me the other day. He's 18. He says, "How did you get so popular?" I said, "That's because I'm just am, and you're not. What can I say?" I mean, he cracks up. He says, like, "How did you?" And I said, "If you put old over there, I will not help you with your next college essay. What can I say?" I am going to try to schedule, I'm not sure when, a magazine launch to launch MJ Magazine, the second edition. I am going to email you so that you could join us for the magazine launch and have some fun.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm not sure when I'm going to do it, if I'm going to do it in December or January or whenever. But when I do, I will email you well in advance. And all we do is we talk about the magazine. You get to promote your books and anything else you want. And we talk about the articles and the purpose of the magazine. And I invite certain people, you know, that I want on the show. Before I forget, I am totally excited. December 9th. I'm getting interviewed.
Oh, yay.
Yay, finally. there is a guy that's on NPR, but he's also on Blog Talk, and his name is Cyrus Webb. And from what I understand, he's got about a million listeners, they say. And he invited me to be on his show. With joining me will be Donald Riggio, Mark Rubenstein, and Jeff Marsh. We're going to talk about the magazine. I have no idea what he's going to ask me, and I guess I'll figure it out when the time comes. But that's December 9th at 1. When I get the link, I will definitely promote it. On December 5th at 4, believe it or not, I am going to interview Archer Mayer. 3 can keep a secret. And on December 19th, the one and only John Land, The 10th Circle. If you really want to read a book to scare the daylights out of you, you've got to read that. It is absolutely fantastic. What happens when his main character goes into a nuclear plant, and what happens there is scary. And this other character, Jeremiah Rule, who is into a cult and how he brainwashes people, that's even scarier. And his purpose is even worse. And on January 15th, I'm going to interview the queen of drag herself, Dolores DeLuce, counterculture drag queen. And it's interesting. Her life is quite colorful, and her story is quite interesting, too. So that should be a lot of fun. The title of the book is My Life is a Four-Letter Word, and I won't say which one it is. But I want to thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you, Fran.
I always enjoy talking to you, too. And as soon as I set this up, I will definitely do that. And when I get your next two books and read them, I will definitely, as a matter of fact, you have that book coming, the novella coming out with those other two authors. If they want to do the show with you, let me know.
Oh, that would be fun.
We could talk about the book, and we could talk about the novella and how it is to write together as a team, because I think a lot of people want to know what happens when more than one person writes, you know, different stories. And if they're
perfect,
you know,
that would be fun.
That would be a lot of fun. So as soon as I get it's Island Promises, right?
Yes, and I'll drop it in the mail tomorrow. I'm heading to the post office, so I will drop it in the
mail.
Oh,
good. Thank you. And then maybe we could set something up for February.
Okay. Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And every
email.
I will.
Okay. All right.
Bye.
Thank you.
Have a great night. Thank you.
You too. Hope you get feeling better. Bye-bye.
Bye.